This is the Hidden Killers podcast. In this episode, we dive into the unsettling case of Jennifer Farber Dulos, who vanished on May 24, 2019. Amidst a divorce and custody battle, her estranged husband, Fotis Dulos, and his partner, Michelle Trokinis, became the center of a shocking conspiracy. Today, we bring you up to the moment coverage from the courtroom as Trokinis faces trial, accused of a role in this presumed murder.
For a transaction of criminal business is now open in session. Honorable Judge Randolph presiding. Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Please be seated. Thank you.
Marshall, would you approach, please?
Yes, sir.
This is the matter of State of Connecticut versus Michelle Trokinis. May the court have the appearances of the parties, please.
Good morning, Your Honor. Michelle Manning for the state.
Your Honor, good morning. May it please the court. Sean McGinnis for the state.
Good morning, Your Honor. Attorney John Schoenhorn representing Michelle Trokinis, who is seated to my left. Michelle. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Audrey Felsen and Michelle Trokinis.
Thank you. There were a number of motions filed yesterday, and there were a number of motions filed today by the defense. What the court intends to do is just indicate what those motions are. The court will not act on all of those motions today. Filed January 10th, 2024, motion for sequestration of witnesses. Now, the court will act on that motion today. So what the court will do is just hear from Attorney Schoenhorn on that motion.
I ask that the court grant that motion as a matter of course, and it would apply to both sides.
Does the state wish to be heard?
Yes, Judge. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Your Honor, the part of my issue with the defense's motion has been alleviated by Attorney Schoenhorn's representation that it would apply to both sides. So with that, obviously, we don't have any objection to the law enforcement personnel and most of the witnesses being sequestered. However, there are members of the Farber family, Your Honor, who wish to be present that are potential witnesses in this case. And I'll just direct the court to State versus Swinton, which is 268 Con 781. It's a 2004 case in which the trial court indicated when there's a request for the victim's family to remain that it would balance the interests of both parties. Specifically, I believe that a fair reading of Swinton is that the defense needs to identify specifically which members of the victim's family they want excluded, And I think the court needs to balance whether or not their presence during particular portions of testimony could potentially influence their trial testimony. And so I think following Swinton, Your Honor, it's incumbent upon the defense to identify specifically who from the victim's family they want excluded, and then I think they need to make a proffer as to how their testimony can be influenced. So we would ask that the court grant the motion with the caveat that the victim's family be allowed to remain in the courtroom.
You wish to be heard, counsel?
Yes, twofold. The first is, I do not know what the family is going to testify to. So it's incumbent upon the state to make a proffer. How am I to make a proffer as to how it will be influenced by other people's testimony unless I know that? So I think that he's put the cart before the horse. If the court were going to, however, consider that request by the state, which is it's discretionary, but it also goes to the issue of a fair trial and due process, they would ask the same for my client's family. As the court is aware, the court has already heard during pretrial hearings from my client's mother, who's present in the courtroom, and if something arises where she might have to testify to some of the matters that she was actually present for, I would ask for that same consideration. But until the state indicates the nature of the testimony, if in fact it does not involve any evidence that would be influenced by someone else, that's a little bit different than, but the normal procedure is that all witnesses that are gonna be called are sequestered, and that was what we would do if we were gonna call any of the members of the family ourselves. Thank you.
Counsel.
So just briefly on that, Judge, that's incongruent with Swinton, which I've cited to the court. I think it's incumbent upon the defense to indicate why they think a victim's family needs to be excluded from the courtroom. And the difference, of course, here is that the defendant's family and the victim's family are not similarly situated. Article 8 of the Connecticut Constitution specifically delineates certain victims' rights, including the right to attend court proceedings. And so therein lies the difference between the Farber family and the defendant's family. So I agree the defense witnesses should be excluded, but the Farber family should be allowed to remain.
Thank you. Well, it is clear that there are competing interests. However, there is constitutional provision that would allow, and this court will use the term according to the constitutional provision, would allow the victims to be present at every stage of the proceeding. That does not mean the victims can be heard at every stage of the proceeding. So the court is going to deny the defense's request that the state identify the members of the family and the nature of the testimony it intends to elicit. However, the court will grant the balance of the motion, indicating that no witness who testifies will be allowed to discuss their testimony after that testimony has been elicited with any other witness who has not yet testified. Filed January 10th, 2024, a motion in limine to preclude hearsay statements by third parties without determination of co-conspirator status. The court believes it does not have to rule on that today. Also, there was a memorandum in support of that motion. January 10th, filing 2024, motion in limine regarding prior bad acts of the defendant. Well, the court probably is not going to anticipate that testimony to come forward today if it were going to be elicited. Probably not today, is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Thank you. Filed January 10th, 2024, motion to preclude layperson testimony regarding cellular site location and geofence evidence. That testimony is not likely to be elicited today.
That's correct, Your Honor.
January 10th, 2024, a motion in limine to preclude pejorative reference to written timelines. That is not going to be elicited today, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Filed January 10th, 2024, a motion in limine to preclude references to victims. Well, that probably is going to be woven throughout the trial. So the court will hear from Attorney Schoenhorn.
Yes. I believe that the case law that I cite in here, particularly the Warholik case, is on point, that the state has to prove that the that Jennifer Doulos was a, quote, victim, unquote. Whatever position we may or may not take, whatever we may think about it, it is something that has to be proved. The case law is clear that unless we stipulate or agree that someone constituted a, quote, victim, unquote, and I would note, I'm not raising that with regard to the Farber family. They have an interest in the matter for the time being, but that's something that has to be proven by the state. At this point, there is no such evidence. And the bottom line is that there have been many cases that have resulted. It's either reversible to allow the state, or for that matter, the court, to refer to any party or any individuals discussed as a, quote, victim, unquote, or it might be harmless error in certain cases, but it's still error. So I want to just make sure that that is not something that gets slipped, and that's why I'm filing it as a motion. It might be accidental, but the bottom line is I don't have any problem with people discussing her by name. They can refer to Miss Doulos. They can call her Jennifer Doulos. They can call her by her first name, or the missing person. What I'm concerned about is starting off suggesting that she's, quote, the victim, unquote, in this case. Might be different if this was Fotis Doulos' trial, but it's not.
I'm hard-pressed to see how it would be any different in any trial. The law is the law on this, Judge, and you know, I think we did this dance during voir dire a little bit. The state intends to refer to Ms. Farber Doulos as either her name or potentially the alleged victim during the course of the trial, and I would just direct the court to State versus Warholik, which is the case that the defense cited, and Warholik specifically, along with State versus Smith, which is cited in Warholik, permits or tacitly indicates that the use of the term alleged victim is different than the term victim itself. And so we are going to be referring to her at times as the alleged victim. We think that that's appropriate. It's alleged in the information that she is in fact the victim. And so that's how we're going to conduct ourselves during the course of the trial.
Thank you. The court is going to read the information to the jury. And that information is going to include language in reference to the name Jennifer Farber Doulos. The designation as an alleged victim would arouse no prejudice. So the reference to victim itself is frowned upon, but alleged victim is acceptable. So the motion is essentially granted in part. January 10th, 2024, motion in limine to preclude law enforcement opinion regarding the credibility or truthfulness of the defendant. That testimony is not likely to be elicited today, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you. Filed January 10th, 2024, motion in limine to preclude reference to the defendant's assertion of her Miranda rights, including request for presence of counsel. Attorney Schoenhorn.
During the hearing on the interrogation videos, portions were played by the state involving the trip from the time of her arrest, where they tried to get her to waive her right to counsel. She said, no, I want to speak to my attorney. And then there's that middle of the night, I'll call it interrogation. They want to just call it, you know, making sure that Mr. Conus is all right. But again, where she asserts her right to counsel at that point, I'm assuming, but I don't know, that the state does not intend to offer those any audio portion of those recordings. And I assume that if anything they're going to play, it begins in the afternoon where Attorney Bowman is present with Mr. Conus. This is to make sure that that doesn't suddenly come in, either through a witness or through the accidental playing of that video.
Good morning again, Judge. Just a couple of things on this. Firstly, I hadn't anticipated that we were going to be hearing argument on this particular motion today, just because I think we're several days away from introducing any portion of the defendant's recorded interviews. But I'll just note for the record that it is inaccurate when the defense says that there's no probative value whatsoever to an invocation. In fact, our case law permits an invocation to show the sequence of events. Now, it can't be used by the jury to draw an adverse inference of guilt. That I agree with them on. But I'll note the interpreter who is translating what I say to the defendant's ears right now. And I raise that, Judge, because if there's gonna be any sort of claim during the course of cross-examination or the trial that the defendant did not understand her Miranda rights, and the fact that she invoked multiple times to the police in advance of that interview, which we're gonna be playing, then we think that the defense opens the door to all these issues in terms of rebutting the inference that she didn't understand her rights. And so I would ask the court not to act on this motion now. I think this issue is going to be fluid, but I disagree with the defense that an invocation could never come into evidence, because that's simply completely contrary to the case law.
Thank you. Again, this testimony is not going to be elicited today. Court would also indicate that the court denied the defense's motion to suppress those 8 hours of essentially interrogation by the police of the defendant. January 11th, 2024, filed today. Motion in limine to preclude the use of inconclusive and, in quotes, cannot be eliminated, end quote, DNA results. That's not likely to be elicited today. January 11th, filed today. Motion to preclude irrelevant videos or opinion of unidentified bicyclist. Is that unlikely to be elicited today?
Judge, it is. And I do just, can I just have a moment to consult with Attorney Schoenhorn, because we don't have copies of these.
Yes.
You know,
I don't have them.
They're here.
Yeah, I wasn't sure which ones were.
Judge, may we take up the motions that were filed today, perhaps at a break, or for the court to know what they are for the record, of course. We don't have copy right now, so.
Thank you. Court still wants to put on the record what was filed today. And we need not, because the state is just receiving copies, we need not take up any of the balance of the motions filed today. January 11th, 2024, motion in limine to preclude all evidence of alleged domestic discord between Fotis Doulos and Jennifer Doulos. Filed today, January 11th, 2024, motion to preclude videos or opinions of unidentified red truck. Filed today, January 11th, 2024, motion in limine to preclude speculation, lay opinion, and prejudicial descriptions of blood-like stains. Is that likely to come in today?
Yes, Your Honor, that is likely to come today. May I have a copy of that?
Attorney Schoenhorn, do you wish to be heard?
Yes, I mentioned when I met with the state yesterday afternoon that I was working on that motion. This motion is in conjunction with the, there's two motions. There's the presumptive blood testing evidence and this motion together. I cite the same case, State versus Moody, and I'll just quote, because I quoted in my motion. It specifically says, the result of the presumptive test for blood has no probative value whatsoever. The test result did nothing toward establishing the likelihood of the presence of human blood In that case, I put in brackets, it's on a piece of clothing. Therefore, we hold that the test result was entirely irrelevant, and thus the trial court abused its discretion by admitting it into evidence. And that's on page 628 of the Moody case. I also cite two out-of-state cases, which, if I recall, are also stand for the same proposition from New Jersey and Arkansas. It's one thing for a witness to say, well, I saw something that, you know, was red or it looked like a stain, so I took pictures of it. I'm not going to object to that. But having a police officer say something is blood or blood-like, or that they sprayed it with luminol, or there's something else called KM, which is called Castle-Meyer. That's just a reagent test that glows if something to start, but rust, all these other things also glow. So this case, as far as I, and I asked the court to look at it before ruling on that, specifically says it was abuse of discretion to even allow it in. Many of the items that they sprayed this on turns out not even to be human, not even to be organic. So it will confuse the jury, especially early on in the case. The state can put on witnesses if they took pictures of a bunch of things, but I object if they're going to try and say, well, we sprayed it and it, you know, gave us a presumptive test when the case law says it's not to come in for any purpose whatsoever.
Well, that addresses the motion for the presumptive blood testing. Court is interested first in the motion concerning the description of blood-like stains.
I would note that it seems to me, and I've read hundreds of reports, anything that was brown, greasy looking, or red, they called blood-like. And it turns out many of those things, I don't have to list them, but many of those things were tested, found not to contain blood. So it's the same thing. It's a pejorative description of an item. They can say it was a brown stain, it was a red stain. I'm not going to object to that. It's their idea of calling it blood-like. So it starts the case off with the jury thinking, aha, we don't even need to hear from any expert on whether it's blood or not. The first thing we're going to hear is the police have decided this is blood, and that's all we need to hear. So I don't know how the court will be able to instruct the jury to disregard that once it comes out. That's why I'm filing it as a motion.
If I may, Your Honor. But counsel did mention yesterday that he would be objecting to this term. However, I did not get his motion or the case. What I would indicate with respect to Moody, Your Honor, it's a 1990 case where the sole evidence relating to a blood-like stain that was tested was a small drop on a sole of a shoe that was so small that after the presumptive test was done, no further testing could be done. The court over the next 28 years has walked back Moody and relied more on Schaefer, which is a 1978 case, and I can give the case citation to the court, which, if I can have a moment, which actually indicates that a layperson may also testify as to their observations of a item being blood. The court has walked that back in State v. walked back Moody, I should say, in State v. Grant, which is 286 Con 499, a 2008 case, and indicates that Moody distinguishes Moody because it was based on such a small piece of item, a small droplet that, and I'll just read this straight through. It says, presumably, therefore, it had been too small for a person of ordinary knowledge or experience to make any reasonable inference on the basis of personal observations. And they go on to conclude that Schaefer sets forth a better rule. I do think also I would refer Your Honor's attention to State v. Downing, which is 68 Con App 388, 2002 case. That case actually also walks back Moody and indicates that it's not just the fact that you have a droplet that looks like a blood-like stain. It's in context. Also, there are other considerations, such as was it tested later? Where is there any evidence in the entire case itself or presented in the testimony. In that case specifically, it indicates the stains, evidence that the stains were blood were based on Factors such as their color, their shape, their location in the scene or the area, all things that were taken into account to fall more in line with Schaefer than Moody. So the state would object.
Very briefly.
Briefly, counsel.
The items that are going to be testified to are tiny little drops. There is not a large pool of anything. And so it's those cases do not apply. The fact that a lay witness might say it looked like blood, there was a body on the ground, there was blood next to it. I'm not objecting to anything like this. I'm objecting to police officers saying, oh, there are these drops here. Some of them, they're very small. Some of them were tested, some were not. And I'm more concerned that they're using this reagent spray, which no cases, and I'm surprised to hear the state suggesting that the appellate court overruled the Supreme Court, which in my experience has never happened, but that the fact that there may be some fact-specific cases where something is in a different scenario doesn't overrule it. Moody has not been overruled. And I'm more concerned that both the description of these tiny little dots saying, oh, that's blood or blood-like, and then it gets carried over, and then it gets tested at the laboratory, and it's not blood, it's not blood-like, it's not even organic, to put that idea in the head. I mean, there are these little tiny drops is what we're talking about. The suggestion that there's a large pool of blood, as was placed in the public record in the arrest warrant, simply is not true. So for the state or for the court, for that matter, to suggest that, well, maybe it'll be harmless error, maybe we can distinguish that case. The whole point of these filing these motions is to prevent that kind of prejudice from happening. So based on that, Your Honor, I'm asking the court to grant the motion.
Thank you. Of course, if there were testimony of this nature, what did you see? I saw blood. There'd be an objection. What's the objection? Foundation sustained. Here, blood-like stains does not have the same force. In addition, one cannot assume that the jury will close its ears to cross-examination and not be overwhelmed by the phrase blood-like stains. So the motion is denied. Now, concerning the presumptive blood testing, that is not likely to come into evidence today, correct?
It will tomorrow, Your Honor.
We will take it up tomorrow.
Thank you.
Is the jury ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
You can bring them in. Time when the jury is brought in and the attendance is taken, no identifying information will be disclosed of any juror. Ladies and gentlemen, first we will take the attendance and then we'll be sworn in. Madam, what the court is going to do is talk to you about some of the instructions that shall guide your deliberations. It will also include a reading of the information again, which you have already heard. The court must read it again. This is a criminal case. The state has brought charges against Michelle Traconis, and the court will now read that information. Paul J. Forensic, State's Attorney for the Judicial District of Stamford, Norwalk, charges, count one, conspiracy to commit murder. At various times and in various locations, including but not limited to the town of New Canaan on or about the 24th day of May 2019, in the area of 69 Wells Lane, Michelle Traconis, with intent that conduct constituting the crime of murder be performed, did agree with Fotis Doulos and other persons to engage in and cause the performance of that conduct. And one of them did commit an overt act in pursuance of the conspiracy, to wit, Fotis Doulos did assault Jennifer Farber Doulos in her home on the 24th day of May 2019, with the intent to restrain and kill her in violation of sections 53A-48A and 53A-54A, subsection A of the Connecticut General Statute. Count two, conspiracy to commit tampering with physical evidence. And the aforesaid state's attorney further accuses the defendant, Michelle Traconis, of conspiracy to commit tampering with physical evidence and charges that on or about the 24th day of May 2019 in the city of Hartford in the area of Albany Avenue, the defendant Michelle Traconis, with the intent that conduct constituting the crime of tampering with physical evidence be performed, did agree with Fotis Doulos to engage in and cause the performance of that conduct. And one of them did commit an overt act in pursuance of the conspiracy, to wit, the defendant, Michelle Traconis, traveled with Fotis Doulos to the Hartford area for the purpose of disposal of physical evidence relating to the murder of Jennifer Farber Doulos in the city of Hartford on the 24th day of May 2019 in violation of section 53A-48 and 53A-155A1 of the Connecticut General Statute. Count three, tampering with physical evidence. And the aforesaid state's attorney further accuses the defendant, Michelle Traconis, of tampering with physical evidence and charges that on or about the 24th day of May 2019, within the city of Hartford, in the area of Albany Avenue, the defendant, Michelle Traconis, believing that a criminal investigation conducted by a law enforcement agency was pending and about to be instituted, and an official proceeding was pending and about to be instituted, did alter, destroy, conceal, and remove a thing with the purpose to impair its availability in that criminal investigation and official proceeding, in violation of section 53A-155A1 and 53A-8A of the Connecticut General Statute. Count four, conspiracy to commit tampering with physical evidence. And the aforesaid state's attorney further accuses the defendant, Michelle Traconis, of conspiracy to commit tampering with physical evidence and charges that on or about the 29th day of May 2019 in the town of Avon, in the area of 265 West Main Street, the defendant, Michelle Traconis, with the intent that conduct constituting the crime of tampering with physical evidence be performed, did agree with Fotis Doulos to engage in and cause the performance of that conduct, and one of them did commit an overt act in pursuance of the conspiracy, to wit, Fotis Doulos did transport a 2001 Toyota Tacoma used in the commission of the murder of Jennifer Farber Doulos to Russell Speeder's car wash in Avon on the 29th day of May 2019 for the purpose of having evidence relating to that murder concealed and destroyed in violation of sections 53A-48A and 53A-155A1 of the Connecticut General Statute. Count five, tampering with physical evidence. And the aforesaid state's attorney further accuses the defendant, Michelle Traconis, of tampering with physical evidence and charges that on or about the 29th day of May, 2019, within the town of Avon, in the area of 265 West Main Street, the defendant, Michelle Traconis, believing that a criminal investigation conducted by a law enforcement agency was pending and about to be instituted, and an official proceeding was pending and about to be instituted, did alter, destroy, conceal, and remove a thing with the purpose to impair its availability in that criminal investigation and official proceeding, in violation of section 53A-155A1 and 53A-8A of the Connecticut General Statutes, and finally count six, hindering prosecution in the second degree. And the aforesaid state's attorney further accuses the defendant, Michelle Traconis, of hindering prosecution in the second degree and charges that on or about the 29th day of May 2019 in the town of Avon, in the area of 265 West Main Street, the defendant, Michelle Traconis, did render criminal assistance to another person when, with intent to prevent, hinder, and delay the discovery and apprehension of, and the lodging of a criminal charge against Fotis Doulos, whom she knew and believed had committed a Class A felony, to wit murder, did provide Fotis Doulos with transportation and other means of avoiding discovery and apprehension in support of Fotis Doulos' effort to conceal, alter, and destroy evidence of the murder contained within a 2001 Toyota Tacoma, in violation of sections 53A-165A3 and 53A-166 of the Connecticut General Statute. Now, as mentioned before, the information that the court has just read is not evidence. It is only the formal means of bringing charges, and you may not consider the information as evidence. You may not draw any inference of guilt because the defendant has been arrested and charged. Each charge is set forth in the information as what is called a separate count. In deciding the case, you must consider each charge separately. Every defendant in a criminal case is presumed innocent, and as we explained to you earlier, the presumption of innocence works this way. If you were asked right now whether Michelle Traconis was guilty or innocent, the answer is not, I don't know. The answer is not guilty because you have heard nothing to overcome the presumption of innocence. That presumption remains unless you unanimously decide that the state has proven guilt beyond a reasonable doubt for each of the offenses. The burden is on the state to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and that is called the burden of proof. The burden of proof never shifts to the defendant. If you do not find at the conclusion of all of the evidence that the state has proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant has committed every element of an offense, you must find the defendant not guilty of that offense. On the other hand, if you are satisfied that the evidence establishes guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, you should not hesitate to find the defendant guilty. The procedure for the trial is as follows. After these instructions, the state will present its evidence. Of course, the defendant has the right to cross-examine. The defendant may, if he chooses, present evidence. As you recall, the defendant is presumed innocent. The defendant does not have to prove innocence. If the defendant chooses to present evidence, the state may have the opportunity to present what is called rebuttal evidence. After all of the evidence has been presented, the lawyers will make their closing arguments. The closing arguments themselves are not evidence. You may consider the arguments in your deliberations, but those arguments do not constitute evidence. The state will argue first, this is in regard to the closing argument, according to our rules, and then the defendant will argue. The state has the opportunity to argue after the defense. The defense will not have a second opportunity to argue. However, each side receives the same amount of time for argument.
state may break its argument, however, into two parts if it chooses. When the arguments have been completed, the court will instruct you on the law which applies in this case. You must apply the law as the court instructs. After the instructions, you will be sent to the jury room to begin your deliberations. This is the first time you will discuss the case with your fellow jurors and with no one else. Once deliberations start, all deliberations are to be conducted in the jury room when all of the jurors are present. When you deliberate, you apply the law, as the court will instruct, to the facts in the case. And this is how you reach your verdict, and your verdict has to be unanimous. The court's responsibility includes conducting the trial in an orderly and a fair and an efficient manner. It also includes ruling on questions of law arising during the trial and instructing you on the law as it applies in this case. It is your duty to accept the law as the court states it. During the trial, the court will have to rule on objections and make comments to counsel. The court may also ask questions of witnesses and, of course, tell you what the law is. The rulings, the questions to witnesses, the comments, and the instructions are not to be taken by you as any indication of this court's opinion concerning how you should determine the facts in this case. If you come to believe that this court has expressed or intimated any opinion concerning the facts, you should ignore the opinion you believe the court has formed. And as stated earlier, the role the court has is to ensure a fair trial so that you may decide the case. As jurors, you may disregard all comments the court makes in arriving at your own findings. You must not take anything the court says or does during the trial as an indication of what the court thinks of the evidence or what your verdict should be. You are the sole and exclusive judges of the facts, and you determine the weight of the evidence that you will hear. You determine the value and the effect of the evidence. And you determine the credibility of witnesses. You must consider and weigh the testimony of all the witnesses who appear before you, and you alone are to determine whether to believe any witness and the extent to which any witness should be believed. It is your duty to resolve any conflicts in the testimony and to determine where the truth is. You may draw any and all inferences from the evidence which reasonably and logically flow from the evidence. Now, what will the evidence consist of? The evidence will consist of the testimony of witnesses, documents, and other materials admitted as exhibits. Evidence may also consist of any facts on which the lawyers agree or which the court may instruct you to accept. The following do not constitute evidence, and you may not consider them as evidence in deciding the facts of the case. Statements and arguments by the attorneys are not evidence. Questions and objections of the attorneys are not evidence. And the testimony which the court indicates to you you should disregard should not be considered. Now, there are two kinds of evidence, direct and circumstantial. Direct evidence is testimony by a witness about what that witness personally saw or heard or did. And circumstantial evidence is indirect evidence, that is, evidence from which you can infer another fact. Now, this example has been used many times. If you wake up in the morning and you see the roadway is wet, the inference that you can draw is that it rained during the night. However, the wet roadway is circumstantial evidence that it had rained. Other evidence may provide another explanation, such as a sanitation truck hosing down the street. Therefore, before you decide a fact has been proven by circumstantial evidence, you must consider all of the evidence in the light of reason, experience, and common sense. In deciding the case, you may consider both direct and circumstantial evidence. The law gives you permission to give equal weight to both direct and circumstantial evidence. You must decide how much weight to give any evidence. Some evidence may be admitted for a limited purpose, and if the court instructs you to consider some piece of evidence for a limited purpose, you must consider it for that purpose and for no other purpose. Now, in deciding the facts of the case, you judge the credibility of the witnesses. You will have to decide which witnesses to believe or not believe and the extent to which you credit any witness's testimony. You may believe everything a witness says or only part of it, or you may believe none of it. You may not credit or discredit a witness based solely on which side has called the witness. Now, police officers will testify in this trial, and you must determine the credibility of police officials in the same way and by the same standards as you would evaluate the testimony of any witness. The testimony of a police official is entitled to no special or exclusive weight merely because it comes from a police official. You should recall his or her demeanor on the stand and manner of testifying and weigh it just as carefully as you would the testimony of any other witness. You should neither believe nor disbelieve the testimony of a police official just because he or she is a police official. Court will talk to you now about objections. During the trial, one lawyer may object to a question asked by another. It is the lawyer's responsibility to object to a question if he or she thinks the answer is inadmissible, according to the rules of evidence. You should not hold anything against the lawyer because he or she objects to a question. After the objection is made, the court will rule on the objection. If the objection is sustained, the question will not be answered. You should not speculate about what the answer would have been or the reason the question was asked. If the objection is overruled, the witness will be permitted to answer the question. There may be times when you may be excused so that the lawyers can make more extensive arguments concerning the objections, and those arguments may include a discussion of evidence which the court may eventually exclude. You will be excused so that you do not hear evidence that is not properly admissible. Now, you have taken an oath that will govern your conduct, and from this point, or from the point you took the oath until the court discharges you, after you have rendered a verdict, that oath remains in effect. The oath and the rules place you under an obligation to do certain things and to avoid certain things. The court will review those now. First, you must decide the case based on the evidence presented here in court and the law, as the court will explain it. Second, do not make up your mind about the verdict until after you have heard all of the evidence, the closing arguments of the lawyers, the instructions on the law, and after you and your fellow jurors have discussed the evidence. You may not perform any investigations or research or experiments of any kind on your own, either individually or as a group. Do not visit the scenes of any of the places mentioned in the course of the evidence. Of course, if you are already familiar with any of these places or scenes, you cannot erase that from your memory. Do not research anything online. Do not consult dictionaries for the meanings of words or any other reference material for general information on any subject that comes up during the trial. Do not review any statutes that have been referred to, and the reason is that the parties have a right to have the case decided on the evidence presented here in court. If you conduct some research and investigation, the verdict may be the product of evidence the parties had no opportunity about which to ask questions during direct and cross-examination. If you see media reports anywhere, avoid them. That includes radio, television, live stream, blogs, any internet site. They may contain information that has not been introduced here, and that information may be inaccurate. The court will also indicate to you, do not watch any recordings of the trial at any time before you render a verdict. So in other words, when you go home, do not decide to go to a website to review the evidence that was presented here in court. that's like taking your notes home, which are not allowed in addition to that. You may hear commentary by commentators about the evidence. Those commentators may or may not have been here, and they may taint the way you view the evidence. Also, you may not talk to members of your family or friends or coworkers about the case. You may not talk to anyone who has anything to do with this case about the case. So in other words, do not try to talk to the lawyers or the marshals or the clerk. You may not ask any acquaintances who are lawyers or law enforcement personnel for advice or information about matters related to the case. The reason for these precautions is that in talking to others, you may be influenced by matters that have not been introduced as evidence in this courtroom, and that would not be fair to the parties and may result in a verdict based on something other than the evidence and the law. And you may not talk to each other about the case. Even if you go to lunch together, you may not talk to each other about the case. Until all of the evidence is in, you've heard the closing arguments, you've heard the instructions on the law, and the court instructs you to deliberate in the deliberation room. The problem with discussing the case before all of these things occur is that you may begin to take positions on the case before you have heard the entire case. And you may stake out your positions before you hear all of the evidence, and you may be inclined not to deliberate with an open mind. To be fair and to fulfill your obligations as jurors, you must resist the temptation to discuss the case with each other before you are supposed to. Now, what happens if you do discuss the case with each other before deliberation? In some cases, violations result in hearings after the trial which the juror alleged to have engaged in those conversations must testify about his or her conduct. In some cases, the verdict has been set aside and a new trial ordered because of juror misconduct. So it is very important to abide by the rules. If someone tries to talk to you about the case, please report it to the clerk immediately. If you see or hear anything of a prejudicial nature or anything that you believe may compromise the proper conduct of the trial, please report that to the clerk immediately. These communications with the clerk should be in writing. Do not discuss the matters with your fellow jurors. Now, if you decide to, you may take notes during the trial. You are never required to take notes. Even if a fellow juror is taking notes, you do not have to take notes. Notes are a good tool to help you refresh your recollection, but sometimes your notes about some of the evidence may not always match your actual recollection of the evidence. If there's a conflict between your notes and what you actually remember, it is your recollection that must prevail. If there is a conflict between a fellow juror's notes and your recollection must prevail. Remember, please, that your notes are not evidence. Your verdict will be based on the evidence and the law given. And if you would like testimony played back, you may request the court to have testimony played back. There's no need to try to write down everything. And your note-taking should not distract you from focusing on the witness. The credibility that you ascribe to a witness is critical. So note-taking should not interfere with your ability to view the witness as he or she is testifying, to listen to the witness, and evaluate the witness's testimony. What the witness is saying and how the witness says it is critical to your evaluation of the testimony and what weight you will give to that testimony. Now, the notepads that will be given to you will be collected at the end of each trial day and kept secure and confidential. No one is permitted to look at your notes. You will not be allowed to make or modify your notes outside of court, and you are not allowed to compare notes with fellow jurors during the trial. Once deliberations begin, you may discuss your notes. Now, the amount of notes that you take should not influence your personal recollection. Now, during the trial, the court will also take notes. Do not be influenced by the court's note-taking. Realistically, you cannot know what the court is writing. If you desire to have a portion of the testimony read back, once your deliberations have begun, do not hesitate to request that. Please, again, do not look up anything on the internet concerning information about the case or any of the people involved, including the defendant, the witnesses, the lawyers, or the court. Please do not use internet maps or Google Earth or any other program or device to search for or view any place discussed during the course of the trial. Now we conclude with the lawyers having informed the court that the evidentiary portion of the trial will take about 6 weeks. This is an estimate. We don't intend to, or we should say, it is unlikely the case will go as far as March 1st. The court will attempt to keep you informed of changes in the schedule. Once the evidentiary portion is over and the court directs you to deliberate, the length of the deliberations will be up to you. Again, we start every day at 10 o'clock. We take our break around 11:15, come back in, and then take our lunch break at 1 o'clock from 1 to 2, lunch break, 2 o'clock to 3:15, evidentiary portion of the trial. Then we conclude at 4:45. If you wish to communicate with the court during the trial, please send it out in the form of a note. The note will be read to the parties and made a part of the record. If you have a question, please write it down and give it to the marshal, who will bring it to the court. Now it's about 11:15. The court has concluded its comments. We'll take our morning recess, and we're going to resume at 11:30. And that's when the evidentiary portion of the trial will start. So we'll stand in our recess.
There's more to come at the Michelle Trokinas trial in the Jennifer Farber Doulos case. The mystery deepens and justice seeks its course. Press subscribe now and stay tuned for more episodes unraveling the truths behind the most perplexing criminal cases from true crime today.